We'll call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee to order. And we do not have a quorum yet, members, and so when we do, we'll just do a brief interruption to get some of the business in the minutes passed. But for now, we'll start with our first testifier. And members, we're going to have a presentation from the Minnesota Rural Health Association for about 15 minutes, and then from there we're going to go in and hear a Representative Keel's bill dealing with some of the issues that will be addressed by the Minnesota Rural Health Association and some of the challenges we're dealing with rural health. And so with that, we have Steve Gottwald here, who's the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Health Association. Welcome back to the committee. I want to say Representative Gottwald. If you want to introduce yourself for the record, you can proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, my name is Steve Gottwald. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Health Association. We are a membership organization representing dozens of hospitals, clinics, providers, medical educators from all around the state, nursing homes, particularly obviously representing greater Minnesota and rural issues. And as you'll see in this presentation, Madam Chair and members, we face a different set of challenges in rural areas than we do here in the Twin Cities metro area. And those concerns or those issues and challenges really kind of demand some immediate attention. They're getting to be very critical. And so we do appreciate Representative Keel's bill, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we move through the presentation. So as I mentioned, rural communities in Minnesota are pursuing the triple aim of greater access to higher quality, lower cost health care, and trying to improve health and wellness, but they're doing it facing unique challenges that are not necessarily being faced as much by people living in the metro area. Some of those challenges are an increasingly older and lower income population, and that population relies more heavily on public programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and others that tend to pay providers below cost. An older and dramatically shrinking healthcare workforce, both in primary and specialty care, we see shortages with fewer new providers coming up to replace them. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, other providers are under increasing financial stress in rural communities, and many of them having to close their doors. We have limited access to dental, mental health, obstetrics, and other specialty care in rural communities. The new health care requirements under the Affordable Care Act and other state-based reforms are asking a lot of rural providers, but they have fewer resources to achieve them. The need for access to a skilled healthcare workforce and data analytics is also creating a great deal of pressure in rural communities. So some top issues, and this isn't an exhaustive list, but it's the top issues impacting rural health at this time. The healthcare workforce shortage you've heard a great deal about, we'll hear more about as Representative Keel discusses House File 211. Access challenges, transportation, broadband shortage, reimbursement disparities, and hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, all in crisis. The healthcare workforce shortage, the Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Hospital Association, and the Department of Health have all predicted that we're going to have a physician shortage somewhere between 800 and a few thousand, depending on how you're looking at it, in both primary and specialty care in rural communities. We've got fewer medical students choosing primary care, which is a top priority. Lack of funding, facilities, faculty, and the federal cap on residency slots are creating barriers to getting more rural health care providers trained and into the pipeline. We have recruiting challenges, including the cost of recruiting. Smaller health systems, smaller hospitals have a much harder time spending the kind of money to compete for a limited resource of health care providers. The pay disparities might be obvious to you, call rotations, spousal employment. If you're recruiting a provider to rural Minnesota, you've also got to find a way to employ their spouse. Otherwise, there's less chance that they're going to come and work in rural communities. The population per physician, this is just to illustrate, in the Twin Cities metro area, we're at about 297 people per physician. If you get all the way out to rural isolated, that goes to 2,043 people per physician. So even though you have sparser population, the numbers per provider are pretty dramatic. The access challenges, a growing shortage of primary care, as we mentioned, but also a shortage of specialty care. particularly in the area of obstetrics, mental health, dental care, language interpreters, and cultural navigators, and pharmacy with medication therapy management, all of them critical needs in the specialty area. In transportation, rural Minnesotans list access to transportation as their top concern in the healthcare arena, especially among seniors who often require door-to-door rides, but public services are not available to accommodate it. Consequently, you have a lot of volunteer efforts in rural communities, often operating in obscurity and with limited resources, kind of filling the gaps. The broadband shortage you may have heard of, and there's other legislation that's been brought forward to try to address that. We know that part of the solution in rural areas is to bring healthcare to the people using technology. So that means telemedicine, telemental health, teleeducation, telemonitoring, telephone applications, robotic assistance. All of them are vital in that effort of trying to extend limited resources to rural communities and expert resources. The problem is many portions of rural Minnesota don't have enough broadband access or enough bandwidth to accommodate that kind of telehealth. We have reimbursement disparities, again, because rural providers rely more heavily on public programs, and public programs are typically paying below cost. This problem for providers across the state is exacerbated in rural areas because of the reliance on public health care programs. So despite a high percentage of Minnesotans with health insurance now, many are still facing unaffordable deductibles and other barriers to covering health care costs, and that's particularly difficult in rural areas where you have a more aged and poorer population. Hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes in crisis. Most hospitals in rural Minnesota are operating in the red or with margins of less than 5%. Now imagine that for a business. This is part of why we have such a difficult time in rural communities delivering health care and making it sustainable. The health care infrastructure in much rural Minnesota is a web of small hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and nursing homes often attached to hospitals, experiencing significant financial stress, as I described, many of them with stresses that make it almost impossible for them to support investments in critical plant and technological upgrades. So they're having a hard time just taking care of what they've got. Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates, I've already touched on this, but generally below actual cost and creating a significant amount of stress for these rural facilities and rural providers. Long-term care facilities that you'll hear a lot about this session at risk of closure because of these situations. So at the end of it, we're trying to achieve and maintain health and wellness. And the latest studies, a study by the University of Wisconsin, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation also, ranked the overall health of Minnesotans by county and found that the worst health problems, not surprisingly, are found in rural parts of our state. Again, a more aged, poorer population, more distance from the health care that they need, and that health care in stress. The poorest health care outcomes particularly concentrated in northern and northeastern Minnesota. So we'll put in a plug here, Madam Chair and members, for House File 211, Senate File 3. We strongly support that bill because of the critical need for such providers in our rural communities. And I hope I brought that in under 15 minutes, but with that, Madam Chair, either we can move to maybe Representative Keel's presentation, or I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gottwalt, and you did. You brought in with time to spare on your allotted time. And just really quickly, members, just want to announce we do have a quorum present, so we'll officially call the meeting to order. And also with that, I want to see if anyone will move the minutes for January 28th.
So moved.
Representative Albright moves the minutes for January 28th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. We have a question, Mr. Gottwalt, from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gottwalt, you mentioned this bill takes care of one leg of the stool or table. Can you highlight the other key legs that would be required to ensure?
Mr. Gottwalt.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the presentation started out with kind of a list of top priorities, and I think what you're getting at is there's a lot more out there. There are a lot of issues in rural health that are really in a critical situation, and so we're trying to call attention to this with this presentation. We hope to do this perhaps on an annual basis. Representative Keel's bill, House File 211, addresses actually only one portion of the workforce challenge that we face. We are trying in many organizations and in many areas to identify outside-the-box thinking to try to figure out how do we get an adequate supply of health care providers, both in primary care and specialty care, to rural communities. Some of it involves trying to grow our own. You know, are we reaching students in high school? Are we giving them exposure to healthcare careers? Especially in rural communities, these people already love rural life. This is where they've grown up. Many of them, that's where they want to stay. But if they don't see the opportunity for a career or they can't afford it, which is to what House File 211 speaks to, then they're going to leave. And they're going to continue to leave. And that's why we see an increasingly aging population in rural communities. But I mentioned transportation, mental health access is a big deal. Telehealth and mobile medicine are really important. We've got all these experts in places like the Twin Cities and regional centers who are willing to help provide care to rural communities but can't be driving all over. So technology is one aspect, but unless we've got the broadband available and the bandwidth with that broadband, we can't connect those people to the patients that they could be helping serve. So there are some key areas that the legislature, I think, could be getting involved in that would help make a big difference. Broadband's one of them. Several things, including House File 211, that help us address the workforce issue, trying to grow and keep our own in rural communities. Another thing I didn't mention about workforce is we have a lot of immigrants and newcomers coming to rural Minnesota. A lot of people think of the Twin Cities as diverse. There's a lot of diversity occurring in rural areas. And many of those are people who've come to our country with medical skills, but they need the cultural and language translation so that we can actually use them and employ them in our healthcare workforce. So it's really kind of an all hands on deck approach right now that we need to kind of catch up with the disparity between healthcare Twin City style and healthcare in the rural parts of our state. I hope that answered the question.
Seeing no further questions at this point, I understand that Mark Schoenbaum, who is the director of the Office of Rural Health from MDHC, do you have any comments you wanted to add at this time? Want to come forward and just introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. I wear a number of hats there. One of the most important ones is director of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. A pleasure to be here today. To work with Steve Gottwald and the Minnesota Rural Health Association. One of the things that makes rural health work in the state are the strong partnerships, and one of the strong ones is a partnership between the Rural Health Association, which is a freestanding nonprofit organization, and us at the Health Department. I'm fortunate to be able to sit on the board of the Rural Health Association, and again, I think we get a lot more done that way. One thing you will find in your packet is a letter from the state's Rural Health Advisory Committee. Looks like this. That's another part of the partnership. This committee is a 15-member governor-appointed body that advises the Commissioner of Health and other state agencies on rural health issues. They provide policy advice and study important rural health issues. And I think both on behalf of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care and the Rural Health Advisory Committee, we'd just say amen to Representative Gottwald's presentation and priorities. And with that, I won't take up any more of your time on this general subject.
We do have a question. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it seemed an appropriate question for you, Mr. Schoenbaum, because I know you do a lot of important work statewide. And I don't want to in any way take away from the need for us to step up and recognize the shortages in rural areas, particularly what I think is the new title, deep rural, as opposed to, you know, regional centers or that sort of thing. But I did want to point out and see if Mr. Schoenbaum would confer that many of the issues that Mr. Gottwald just went through are also the same sort of issues that our urban areas, particularly urban neighborhoods, face, and that the population for of physicians per 1,000 residents or whatever, I think you'd probably see the same or worse numbers in most of our area, and the reimbursement disparities are the same because they're the standard reimbursement rates, but you have clusters of populations that are more dependent. And I can just say in the 15 neighborhoods that I represent, I have seen major disinvestment. We've had two clinics close that were associated with major health plans, and they chose to move to the suburbs without adequate transportation or anything else because it was more profitable for them. They had a better patient mix, and they left their patients in our area behind, so that the operating clinics that we have now are federally qualified health care centers that have really limited personnel and who are trying to step up in that breach. And so I think that sometimes we forget that we have more in common sometimes than we think. But I think this is a step and maybe a model that we can look at in terms of serving some other areas that are having that same sort of disinvestment, because it's going to be a problem that's not going to go away.
Mr. Yes. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, you make an excellent point, and there are many, many commonalities between rural areas and the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, especially their inner city neighborhoods. Some of the same resources that serve rural areas have parallel projects that also serve safety net providers in the Twin Cities. We have a subsidy program for federally qualified health centers that's available to those safety net providers statewide. I think when Representative Keel gets into her presentation, you're going to see some documentation, some maps that show that parallel, both rural and in Minneapolis and St. Paul. The issues of diversity and new immigrants, as Mr. Gottwald mentioned, is a statewide issue, and there are have been some recent work to look at the cohort of foreign-trained physicians who, if we can figure out how would be available to address those needs, both in our urban and rural areas around the state. So another amen, absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Gottwald, good to see you. Sorry I had to come in a little bit late, but I'm looking at the document that we got and page 10, slide 10. Where you talk about the reimbursement disparities. And the third bullet point here talks about unaffordable deductibles and other barriers, even among people who are insured. And I just wanted to focus on that a little bit because, obviously the way we've got our system right now, we have our people who are on medical assistance don't have those deductibles. But people, obviously, when we get off into people who are on the qualified health plans, who even though they have help with their premiums, the deductibles really are pretty high, and I'm concerned about that. I wonder if you have given any thought to how to start to address that piece of it, because. From my point of view, it's better now that we have more people on medical assistance because many of our low-income folks, in fact, don't have this problem now if they're on medical assistance. But I think we need to extend that ability to actually get health care kind of higher up on the income scale. Does your association have any proposal on that deductible piece?
Mr. Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, no specific proposal, although if we wanted to debate all the strengths and weaknesses of what's coming forward in healthcare changes and reform right now, we'd be here for a long time yet. But the unaffordable deductibles are particularly troubling in rural areas. If you don't qualify for Medicaid, as Representative Liebling points out, and you are on a qualified health plan through MNsure or outside of the exchange even, in some cases you're facing very high deductibles. And as I mentioned, the population in rural communities tends to be more aged and lower income. And so they have an even more difficult time affording the health care that they need. and oftentimes have to supplant what would normally be covered or wouldn't cost much. Some of you might be able to jump in your car and drive a couple miles to health care. Some of these people need to drive 20, 30, 40 miles or get somebody to drive for them, or maybe don't get the care at all until it's too urgent. And so it does tend to be more critical in rural communities, I think, by and large. So how do we do it? I don't know. Some would argue that Medicaid, if we put enough people on it, are we going to be able to afford it? How do we sustain that? And I think our association does have an eye towards, yes, let's think about how to solve these problems. Let's try to do it in a way that's sustainable so we can actually make a promise and keep a promise. And I think that's really important. But figuring out where that line is, how many people we should have on Medicaid, how many people should be on a subsidized qualified health plan, how we deal with the high deductibles that many people are facing now with those qualified health plans, I think that's going to take a lot of heads around the table.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Gottwald. And I think I'm just surmising that problem of collecting deductibles from folks is even more acute when you're out in the rural areas and you might have some providers who have, are more independent or smaller shops and probably have trouble absorbing some of that. Because I know that probably happens quite a bit, that providers end up absorbing some of those uncollectible deductibles. But I imagine that in the rural areas that might be even harder to do.
Mr. Gottwald.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I think that is true. Obviously, the providers are not collecting deductibles. They'd be collecting co-pays if they were. But the fact that these people are responsible for that dollar amount before they get any coverage, which is what a deductible is, I do think providers, especially in rural areas, do face the potential of people not paying those bills, and then that's uncompensated care. So I do know that concern has come up among rural hospitals as well as clinics.
Well, Mr. Gottwald, thank you very much. I think that you have outlined the challenges facing rural health very well and efficiently and effectively. And I think it's been a great primer to the bill that we're going to hear that addresses just one piece of the many challenges that we face. And so with that, we will bring forward Representative Keel, who has House File 211 relating to Minnesota's Loan Forgiveness Program. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. And members, I will move that Representative Keel's bill, House File 211, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development. And members, I'll just remind you that we will, this mostly deals with health policy issues, so it won't be real hard to keep our comments and questions to that. But I do know that there are some questions relating to data issues, but that will obviously be for another committee. So with that, Representative Keel, if you want to present your bill, and then we'll go into testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. This is an opportunity. It is a process already happening in rural Minnesota. And it's very important to make sure that we're providing health care for people, accessibility to doctors, nurses, and we're going to extend this to other forms of health care a little bit. But more importantly, it's to encourage our young people that are coming out of college, have finished their education, a way to help manage their loan, but also to provide rural Minnesota with the health care that it needs, and hopefully they'll either come back to where they grew up or find out that rural Minnesota is a pretty neat place to live and great for their families, and will plant their roots there and live for a considerable long time and provide for our citizens. I know when I think back at when my grandmother's doctor retired, how difficult it was for her. And like most places, we don't like having turnover that much. And so we'd like, that's part of it. We'd like to see our nurses stick around, and those things are important. So we have a little presentation for you. As you've heard through Mr. Gottwald, and we'll certainly see through the other other information here that we're going to present, that rural areas of Minnesota are really finding some challenges in providing doctors and nurses, health care providers. We're going to talk about mental health professionals that are low access to our area. And Representative Loeffler does point out a fact that we'll talk about that in here, that there's some metropolitan issues too. But to dwell on the workforce recommendations, a commission from the Legislative Healthcare Workforce, this is where some of this information came from. I believe Chair Mac. I'm struggling for your name all of a sudden. Anyway, you sat on it along with who else did? I guess Representative Joe Shoemaker. So, anyway, that are here now. So, and then the importance of mental health workforce in this plan to provide our aging mental health workforce. We're losing the few people that we did have in this area, and want to see some assistance as we realize that how important this is. There's a lot of, I won't share some of the information that some of the testifiers are going to come, but there's some real exciting things that happen in rural Minnesota along with our mental health our mental health provisions and also our education, where we're kind of share those responsibilities, and it works very well, but we need more people to do that. So with that, I will turn this over to Mr. Schoenbaum, who is going to explain to you the Department of Health information.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to add another hat now. I have two hats now. As you know, it was our privilege at the Health Department to provide staff support to the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission this past summer and fall. As Representative Keel noted, recommendation precursor to this bill arose from that commission, and so I'm going to talk about some of the background to the issue and tell you about the Health Department's Loan Forgiveness Program. If you take a look at your handout and the screen, you'll see that we have a series of maps. These maps show in both rural and urban areas the areas that are designated by the federal government as health professional shortage areas. There's no such thing as a perfect indicator of shortage or adequacy, and these are not perfect, but they're in common use, and they do give us, you know, one snapshot of what's going on with our healthcare workforce throughout the state. So to the rural maps first, you can see that almost the entire state is designated as a mental health shortage area. Most of the state is designated as having a shortage of dentists available to the low-income population. A lot of the state is designated as having a shortage of primary care providers. And when one looks at the Twin Cities, the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, one finds parallel shortage designations as well in both dental health and primary care. One response, as has been noted well, to these kinds of distribution issues in the healthcare workforce is loan forgiveness to attract new graduates and young professionals to the areas where they are needed most. And if you would turn for a couple of minutes to the handout in your packet on the Loan Forgiveness Program, you will see on the front side, the logo side, a little history on the program, including its budget history. And if you flip it over, you'll see the list of the occupations that are now eligible for loan forgiveness and the requirements that the areas where they must serve in order to maintain that eligibility They're required to serve for a minimum of 3 and a maximum of 4 years. Taking both the slide about the external program evaluation of the program and the recent figures on the handout together, you'll see that not only does the state's loan forgiveness program, has it been documented to attract people to working conditions where they are most needed, but it also has a strong effect in helping people have those first experiences that Representative Keel mentions to establish their professional lives in these high-need areas, and after they have completed their 3 or 4 year obligations, many of them, most of them, remain in the same or a similar setting for 10 and sometimes even 20 years. So the program, looking objectively, appears to be pretty effective. Turn it back to you,
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There would be increases in the funding here in this program. And like I said, it would serve the rural and underserved areas. It would provide an increase of 200 healthcare providers to rural Minnesota over the 4 years, so that you know that isn't just 200 every year. And would include primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, registered nurses to nursing homes, and dentists. I didn't mention this before, but I have one county in my district where they are served. It's a little under 5,000 residents entirely. They have one dentist, and he would like to retire. And I don't think he's going to wait too much longer, but he's talked about it for many years, and that's their conversation often, is the importance of trying to bring dentists back into the area. Anyway, pharmacists and nursing facilities are also part of that. So the addition would be mental health professionals, public health nurses, dental therapists, and of course, like I said, all for rural areas. So would you like to...
If you turn to the next slide, members.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see a few more of the details about both the current and proposed occupations in the loan forgiveness program. You can see the level of debt that the average graduate leaves their education with, and you can see in the middle column the annual loan forgiveness incentive, which is pegged at 15% of that average debt, and you can see the contribution to their loans that a participant receives after being in the program for 4 years. So the program is designed on average to pay off about 60% of a health professional's outstanding student loans. One feature of the program is that the funds are in a single pool that is divided among all of the eligible occupations. So any expansion of the program provides additional resources to all of the occupations it includes, not just the new ones that would be added.
Mr. Schoenbaum, thank you so much. All of these handouts are enormously helpful. Thank you for providing the information. It really sheds light on the program and how robust it's been. We have a couple of questions. Are you concluded with your presentation? Okay. Yes. We'll take a couple of questions quickly, and then we'll move on to testifiers. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just for clarity, that all the loan forgiveness program, a criteria for that is that you go back into the rural community to work?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Representative Moran, if you... turn back to this handout. I don't know if yours is color or not, but it's the one that says loan forgiveness. Then it has these columns on the back. If you look down the left-hand side, you can see the conditions. Many of the occupations do have a rural requirement. The requirement for nurses is that they work in a nursing home or facility for the developmentally disabled, the requirement for dentists is that they serve a high share of Medicaid and other sliding fee scale patients, and the requirement for faculty is that they continue to teach these occupations.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair, so does that include high-risk populations, including communities of color, where there's high poverty?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Schoenbaum.
Representative Moran, many of the occupations have a geographic requirement, and for all but and for all but physicians, it's a rural requirement. We do also accept applications from physicians who propose to work in an urban, medically underserved area, although that has been a very small number over the years.
Okay, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Moran.
So I am sitting here thinking that although I understand the concerns of the rural community and the need of the rural community, but I also believe that there are needs in other communities, right? As we talk about disparities in communities of color, when we talk about the need for more nurses and doctors and physicians of color, we're going to the workforce to work in to make those commitments in high-risk population, you know, and one of the things that, you know, it's reminded me of the support of the Department of Health is, as you has laid out this or support this type of initiative, is that, you know, we have these huge disparities, right? And I know my daughter is up at Mankato majoring in nursing, you know, but I don't think that my daughter, and maybe she would, but with 93% of the rural community being, you know, Caucasian, there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm just saying, you know, would she want to go and live there for the next 4, 5, 6, 10 years? You know, so as we look at, you know, as we look at loan forgiveness, as we look at how we make that a little bit more inclusive of looking at the disparities that continues to grow, I just see this in some ways as another way that we see that growth happening even more. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, how do we encourage, you know, nurses and physicians and healthcare workers of color who go into this position, who are working hard, who are at a disadvantage anyway, you know, how do we also include this in a special classification of a loan forgiveness program so that we are looking at the huge job disparities as become a little bit more equitable?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Representative Moran, you make an excellent point. There are many needs and many needs within the arena of the healthcare workforce, and loan forgiveness is one strategy, one tool to meet a piece of those needs. The list that you see here on this handout are the priorities that the legislature has established, you know, over the years, and, you know, more are before you today. So I think, again, it's always a priority setting decision for you folks.
Representative Moran.
I guess all I can say is that we set these standards and we determine here, which is just, I guess, a matter of fact of what the Department of Health said, that structural racism exists because of the policies that are created right here in this body. And until we're more conscious of the need and the great need that it is for everyone to be able to have a livable wage, to be able to take care of themselves and their family, and to come out of school in high debt, I mean, that touches so many people, you know. And again, you know, we have these huge disparities because of policies like this.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair Mack. I don't know if this question is better directed towards Representative Keel or towards Mr. Schoenbaum. I guess I'll let you determine that. There are a number of healthcare professions that may want to take advantage of this program as well. You know, they may want to practice in a rural area, and this would help them do that. And there's likely also a need for some of those services in the rural area. I have a constituent who is an acupuncturist and has asked about the possibility of her profession being included in this program. From having spoken to Representative Keel, I understand chiropractors and at least one other group has also asked about being included. Just wondering if professions like that have been looked at as part of this task force and putting this bill together, and what you would think of doing that, or if it's just, or if there's kind of budgetary constraints to doing so.
Representative Heiberg, and I know we will be hearing from some of our testifiers with an interest exactly like what you're lining out, but to that, Representative Keel or Mr. Schoenbaum? Representative Keel.
Thank you. I'll make a real quick comment, and Representative Freiberg and I talked about this, you know, the different groupings, and I think it's something we need to work on. I'm not sure if Mr. Schoenbaum has some more information about the studies that were done, and that might be a good thing for us to hear about, you know, what the difference, because I know we're looking at different fields of health care now. Not necessarily do we go to the doctor all the time. We might relieve pain through an acupuncturist or a chiropractor or whatever. So do you have any?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, I'll leave you with a couple of principles about loan forgiveness. For loan forgiveness to be an effective strategy, the profession being considered for inclusion in the loan forgiveness program should meet a couple of attributes. There should be some objective information, accepted, well-established way to understand whether there are shortages of that particular profession and how those shortages play out geographically. So in other words, what, you know, how do you tell that this place has a shortage and that place doesn't, and what is a shortage for the professions in the program now? Physicians, you saw some of the maps with different ratios of what's a good physician to population or dentist to population ratio. So any proposed new occupation, there should be that same kind of objective information that we can use to make decisions. The second criteria is that the graduates from education in the profession should have enough debt. I mean, that's kind of not a criteria that you maybe wish on people, but they should have enough debt that offering payment of the share of that debt is a strong enough incentive to influence where they're going to decide to work. So just two principles I'll leave you with.
Follow up.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenbaum. That's very interesting, Mr. Schoenbaum. I don't know off, to your second point to start with, I don't know off the top of my head the amount of debt an acupuncturist comes out with. But to the first point you raised about needing objective information, did the task force examine this for other fields, like such as, you know, chiropractors, acupuncturists? Is that something you know of? Do you have that information? You said there's a need for that information. I guess the natural question is, do you have it?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, are you inquiring about the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Task Force?
Representative Freiberg.
Yes, yeah, the group that put together the reports and recommendations on strengthening Minnesota's healthcare workforce.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, I'd also invite you as a member of the task force to respond with me, but Representative Freiberg, if I recall correctly, the legislation creating the task force gave it a particular charge to look at the primary care workforce and the primary care medical workforce. So its work in its first year, and it will go on for another 2 years, was really pretty focused on those occupations.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum, and that's what I was going to add to that conversation. If I remember correctly, our conversations really focused around trying to get at the primary care gap for the rural health community and the burden of those physicians and what they carry in terms of loans and how we can recruit them. We have members, Representative Schultz, Representative Baker, Mulry, Albright, Liebling, and Quam with questions. So I'm thinking we'll take those questions now with Representative Keel and Mr. Schoenbaum at the table. We'll cut it off there, go to our testifiers, and then come back to questions. So if we could keep our questions brief to make sure we get to our testifiers. With that, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenbaum and Representative Keel, what's the need for these professions? You mentioned that there'll be 200 awards given out over 4 years. Does that cover the need for these awards to get people to practice in rural areas? Mr. Schoenbaum.
I think you want to say something too, Representative, but I'll start, Madam Chair. Representative, the need varies and depending on the occupation. I think you saw a figure in Steve Gottwald's presentation that there are a variety of projections out there that have analyzed that there will be a shortage of between, I think, 800 and several thousand physicians in Minnesota looking out to 2020 and 2025. There are similar projections for pharmacists and other occupations. I had occasion earlier today to talk to the Essentia system, which covers northern Minnesota. Right now they have 75 physician vacancies and comparable numbers of nurse practitioner and physician assistant vacancies. Depending on what the legislature chooses to do in expanding the loan forgiveness program, the current program makes a difference. It doesn't solve the problem, and if the program is bigger, it would probably make more of a difference.
Representative Keel, did you want to add to that?
Just to point out that part of this is something you can't control. We have an aging workforce that is retiring, and so that is part of the issue here, the nursing, the physicians, the dentistry. You're watching them, mental health, you're watching them retire, and the replacement level is much lower, and that's I don't think it would solve the problem by any means, but it's a direction toward helping. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, and I was just going to point out, too, I think on Mr. Gottwald's presentation, it was on page 3, that kind of lines out where we're at in terms of where we need to be and where this gets us. But Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how do you prioritize who is selected for the program? Do you provide loan forgiveness, for instance, for individuals from other states that have been educated in other states and their loans, or do you take preference for those educated in Minnesota?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, Representative, Minnesota residents get preference. Students who are closest to graduating or completing residency and are kind of actively looking for work get preference, because that's a critical decision point where you can have an influence over them. And the program does get many more applications than it can fund, and applicants submit a personal essay and other information to describe their suitability for work in whatever the condition is, whether it's in a rural area or in a nurse who wants to receive loan forgiveness to a nursing home. They talk about their prior experience, what they've learned in their education, and those applications are ranked against each other.
Thank you.
Representative Mulry.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schoenbaum, first of all, I have the same concerns as Representative Moran, and also, I mean, in inner city communities, for instance, dentists are really, if they're not getting free service, it's really hard to find one. But my question is, while we're hearing all of these problems, I'm also hearing from a lot of people in the community that Minnesota is one of the hardest to get a license for a foreign-trained nurse. And what are you doing if we really have this problem? Why are we so tough on that? And what are you doing to fix that?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, and I'd invite Representative Moran to respond as well. I'm not familiar with the foreign nurse situation, but Representative Moran, last session authored a bill that created a task force to look at the immigrant physicians.
That's just physician.
That are living in Minnesota and could be available to meet these needs. The task force recently published its report and sent it to the chairs. Certainly be willing to get you a copy, and I would look to Representative Moran.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenbaum, I asked about nurses. I know about the physician issue.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
I'm hearing nothing from the
Representative Mullery.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I'm hearing nothing, Mr. Schoenbaum, as far as the department doing anything on that issue. So,
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I honestly have not heard much about the nursing issue. I'd be interested to hear more about it, and we'll look into it and get back to you. I would also suggest that both of us, and I will consult with the Board of Nursing, who is involved in licensing foreign nurses, and I bet they have some knowledge for us as well.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a kind of question that would pertain to some of the testimony that Mr. Gottwald made earlier, and I'm wondering if he could approach the stand.
Mr. Gottwald. Representative Albright.
Mr. Gottwald, I'm looking at this last slide in terms of the loan forgiveness program for rural health, and you alliterated to the idea of broadband and the lack of broadband and telemedicine. And my observation is, if you just think about a hub and spoke type of service model where you have broadband and telemedicine for physician assistants and some of these mid-level providers, whereas the hub itself is providing the more crisis intervention medicine, where are we in terms of providing that opportunity? Is it on the horizon? Is it a long way out? Is it even feasible? Because if you've got very small communities of 1,500 to 2,000 people, it's very unlikely that they will be able to support an MD. But it's very likely that they might be able to provide enough work and or quality of life, quote unquote, for a nurse practitioner or physician's assistant who would coordinate their efforts with someone via broadband, telemedicine, with another entity somewhere away. I'm just wondering if you could speak to that in terms of if that is a viable solution for some of these geographically dispersed areas.
Mr. Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. The reality is technology is helping us address this. I've had the opportunity to observe what's going on in many other states around the country right now. And rural areas across this country right now are struggling and trying to figure this out. And technology is helping to a certain extent. If I heard what you're saying, having mid-level practitioners available may be a little more available in smaller communities than having a full-blown MD or physician. May work well if they're allowed to connect through technology with an MD for supervision. And there are a lot of experiments going on around that. The one I can think of offhand, visited Avera recently down in Marshall, Minnesota. They are using telemedicine for their ER. They don't have an ER doc on hand all the time. They can't afford to do that in that community. But they have access to medical specialists and MDs at some of their larger facilities, and I believe Sioux Falls and Rapid City and so forth, and they're able to connect them immediately with both readings, measurements of what's going on with a person's body, so vital signs, as well as face-to-face consults with the mid-levels and others who are caring for people in a given setting. So that's happening in places. It's not happening universally. The best practices are not being disseminated broadly yet. But one big barrier to having any of that happen is when you just don't have the bandwidth. If you don't have broadband and you don't have the bandwidth to accomplish that kind of technology, then you don't have that opportunity. And those communities, frankly, are in trouble because they don't have the MD, they don't have the mid-levels, and they don't have them working together using the technology.
And thank you for that, Mr. Gottwald. And I don't know if you have a follow-up. We're a little afield from the bill, a very critical issue to talk about, but we will definitely have days where we're talking about telehealth. Just in the interest of the testifiers, trying to keep questions to the bill. Representative Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is back to the bill. And it follows on Representative Moran's comment. I wanted to ask Mr. Schoenbaum, how does this bill that's in front of us advance the Department of Health's equity goals, or how can it be tweaked perhaps to improve it so that it does? Because this is not only about urban and rural, it's really about diversity, and I think we heard, maybe it was from Mr. Gottwald, and we all know that there's growing diversity in rural Minnesota. So how can we make sure that as we do this loan forgiveness, and I have to say I'm very supportive of using loan forgiveness to help get people into shortage areas. I think it's been shown to be a very effective tool. And I'm delighted that we're talking about this and hopefully going to fund some more of this. But I would like to see it advance the department's equity goals at the same time.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, just a point, you all know this is not a department bill, and we're here providing technical assistance to the author, so I would turn to her first, and if she pleases, I'd be happy to perhaps give you the department perspective. But
Representative Keel, any comments to that?
Thank you. I don't see where it is a directed in that area more to provide healthcare for a rural area. I would suspect, though, that, you know, when I sat on the school board, we often looked for different ethnicities because we are having much more diverse populations than we used to. And so, you know, when I grew up, it was unusual to see anybody of color. Hispanic, maybe a little bit more. I was used to growing up with families like that. But to encourage that, I guess I've grown up always with different doctors, different ethnicities. That was just that occurred quite often in the rural areas. I can think of quite a few that somebody in the family saw, but probably not so much in our nursing. But I think that would be a great thing. I mean, I look at the families there, and they would love to see different ethnicities, because I know that. You know, that is what we'd like to see in rural Minnesota, too, so that we are serving everybody, providing opportunity for members or medical staff also. And I don't know, when you decide, Mr. Schoenbaum, when you decide, do you look for those when their students are applying for the loan forgiveness? Is that part of the consideration, or...? Different ethnicities.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
As I mentioned earlier, candidates submit a personal essay describing what they believe, you know, is their suitability for serving in the particular condition. And many candidates do know where they want to work. And so they will talk about their connections to that community. And there are communities all over the state, including the Twin Cities. To the point that Representative Mullery made earlier, the requirement for dentists to receive loan forgiveness is that they serve a high proportion of medical assistants and other sliding fee scale patients. So in the context that many of those patients are patients who experience health disparities, I think that part of the program is responsive. I think the long-term care workforce is one of the most diverse workforces we have in the healthcare sector, and the requirement for nurses in the program are that they serve in a long-term care setting. I think the occupations that the bill proposes to add, mental health professionals, I think you'll hear in a bit that there's a need for a culturally appropriate workforce to respond to mental health needs around the state. So I think, again, loan forgiveness is not a comprehensive strategy to achieve all health equity goals, but I think it does contribute.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this bill isn't to solve all the issues. This bill is about one thing, accessibility, and trying to address accessibility. We don't have the dollars or the waivers to address, you know, under-cost reimbursement, which hits different parts of the state, metro and outstate. This is accessibility. Now, I do wish that we had in the maps not just county and then provider versus the population of the county, but we really need to understand Greater Minnesota and Rural Minnesota as a map that has travel distance to the care, because there are parts of the state that it takes you a long time to travel 30, 40 miles, or that you are 90 minutes, 2 hours, or more drive time to care. And that's an accessibility question that needs to be addressed, and it'd be nice if we had some maps that showed that, because frankly, there are people, as we age, that don't drive after dark through the rural areas because of the, you know, the county roads, etc., and that they plan to leave so they have drive time back. So if you're going an hour and a half, 2 hours one way, that doesn't leave a lot of window to schedule your appointment. And so when we look at this bill, instead of trying to make sure it fixes everything, we can only fix one or two things with each bill, and this is accessibility, and it's to take care of a need, and it's been testified it's only one leg to addressing the problem. And so, you know, I support this. We could also look at nurses compact, physician compact, other things to address different things. But if we're focusing on this bill, it does address accessibility, it does address a need, and it does address people of Minnesota, our citizens, that deserve and need that accessibility.
Okay, members, we're going to move to our testifiers now. And so I will first call forward Shauna Reitmeier. And as it was communicated when you guys signed up to testify to everyone in the audience, we're going to have everyone have about 3 minutes to give their presentation to the committee. And members, where possible, we'll save as many questions as we can to the end, but if you have one for any particular testifier, we'll take it at the end of their testimony. So with that, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Shauna Reitmeier, and I'm the Executive Director for the Northwestern Mental Health Center located in Crookston. And for a frame of reference, it took me 5 hours to drive here today. So thank you for this time. As a rural and frontier community mental health provider, we are in support of this bill. We serve 6 of the most rural and frontier counties. We serve Kitson, Marshall, Polk, Norman, Manoman, and Red Lake counties. And to put that a little bit in perspective, as you talk about the rural and frontier nature of this region, we are about the geographic size of the state of New Jersey. However, the difference is that the state of New Jersey has about 1,200 people per square mile, and we have 8. And so as a rural and frontier region, and as the primary mental health safety net provider for some of our most chronic mental health patients, finding, recruiting, and retaining mental health professionals has been a challenge that we've been struggling with for a long time. And so this bill has a wonderful opportunity to be able to bring that discipline into our region. We've been very fortunate enough to be recognized by the National Health Service Corps because we are a health professional shortage area. However, that program has some limits. This bill has the opportunity to fill that gap. And for example, it could allow for mental health professionals to provide services to our children in our schools. It will allow for people to be seen in their community where they live, in their homes. It could allow for the opportunity to expand the amount of time that could be services that could be delivered through telehealth services, and open up other educational institutions that could qualify for this loan forgiveness program. The success and recovery of individuals with mental health issues requires that we provide services to them where they have access. And for that, it means providing them where they live, in their homes. It means providing them for how much means they have of putting gas in their car in order to get to that appointment, or providing those services in the settings for children where they spend the majority of their time, and that's in the schools. And so the Northwestern Mental Health Center and myself, as a board member of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, we support this bill and thank Representative Keel for bringing this forward, and thank you.
Thank you so much for driving so far to be here today. I feel a little bad now that we only have 3 minutes per testifier. I apologize for that, and thank you so much for driving so far to be here. Members, any questions for this testifier? Okay, if you are able to stay around for a little while longer, just in case there's questions at the end, but thank you for being here. We have Aaron Schindler next. And next after that will be Heather Heathcote Lubin. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Aaron Schindler. I'm a licensed acupuncturist in the state of in Minneapolis, and I'm also the president of the State Acupuncture Association. I've been in practice for 6 years. I have a bachelor's degree in biology, a master's degree in acupuncture and oriental medicine. When I graduated, I had a total of over $100,000 in student loan debt. $60,000 of that was for my bachelor's degree and $44,000 for my master's degree. And I pay around 1/4 of my annual income to my student loan debts every year. So I'd like to tell you that acupuncture is awesome. It's what got me into acupuncture was my first, I was in this car accident. I had a migraine for maybe 3 months. It was like some type of pain I've never had before. And after two treatments with an acupuncturist, this had totally gone. And I was able to go back to my life like normal. I also, acupuncture is one of the fastest growing medical therapies because it's safe, effective, and affordable. It's great at reducing opiate addictions and chemical dependency. Acupuncture is great at relieving pain in general. I know two acupuncturists that work in their community to serve their addiction groups, one in Crookston, Minnesota, and the other in Mankato, where meth addiction is a real problem. They treat patients in group settings with just ear acupuncture, and it's a very affordable way to treat them, and they have great results. I think everyone should have access to this type of medicine, and currently the only program that offers loan forgiveness for acupuncturists is the Indian Health Services Federal Health Program for American Indian and Alaskan Natives. Just a few other points I'd like to make. Doctors of acupuncture are commonly defined as first choice, first entrance, first contact, or first access or portal of entry providers. And acupuncture practitioners act as patient's provider of choice, primary health consultant, frequently assisting the patient in co-managing or coordinating such care when practitioners are involved. And studies are showing that patients seek acupuncture treatment for a wide range of ailments, for which patients commonly see or visit primary care medical doctors. And acupuncturists are not really available in greater Minnesota, and we need more out there. And I believe my higher loans, like the high loans like the ones I have, inhibit that from happening. You know, I practice in Uptown and in the Loop in Minneapolis. Because I have to, the only way I can make a lot of money is if I work in a densely populated area. Now, I also have worked in North Minneapolis out of my home practice, where it's probably half of my practice was a charity, or it's a lot of write-offs just to, you know, to keep people coming in and getting better. But for all the above reasons, we ask that acupuncture be added to the list of providers for loan forgiveness program. and I'd like to thank you for your time and consideration. Any?
Thank you very much, Mr. Schindler. Thank you for being here today. Any questions, members? Okay, next we have Heather Heathcote Lubin. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heather Heathcote Lubin. I'm a practicing advanced dental therapist here to testify in support of this bill. I graduated from the Metropolitan State University Normandale Advanced Dental Therapy Program in 2011, and I currently work for Appletree Dental in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. MNSCU's Advanced Dental Therapy Program admits experienced dental hygienists, most of us with families, who often leave full-time employment in order to advance our education. The expense of school, in addition to the loss of our normal salary, is often quite a stressful burden for our families. We do this, though, because we are committed to providing quality oral health care to those who often need it the most. With both dental therapy programs being based in the Twin Cities, it can be difficult to recruit dental therapists and advanced dental therapists to rural areas. I believe this bill offering loan forgiveness will help future students with the cost of their education, and it will help recruit them to rural areas where access to care needs are often great. The Metropolitan State Program currently has 6 students, 2 of which are from communities in greater Minnesota and would welcome applying for a loan forgiveness program. At Appletree Dental, I provide restorative and preventative oral health care to patients with special access needs, including low-income families, adults with special needs, and nursing home residents. While I do not work in a rural area, we often have patients driving an hour or more to see us for care. We also have clinics in rural areas, including Medelia and Holly, Minnesota. A former classmate of mine is currently working as an advanced dental therapist in Medelia. She would have loved the opportunity to apply for a program such as this. This loan forgiveness could help Appletree Dental recruit dental therapists and advanced dental therapists to work in these rural clinics where finding providers can often be challenging. As Secretary of the Minnesota Dental Therapy Association, I've seen several inquiries of dentists in rural areas looking to hire a dental therapist or advanced dental therapist, including one in my hometown of Sartell, Minnesota. I believe this bill will help current students with their education, as well as to help place dental therapists and advanced dental therapists in rural areas where there are dental access to care needs. I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, members. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate it. Next, we have Jean Anderson. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jean Anderson, and I represent the Minnesota Dental Hygiene Educators Association. I'm a dental hygienist and an educator, and I support the addition of dental therapists and advanced dental therapists to this loan forgiveness program and recognize their ability to provide restorative services, leaving the dentist available to do more complex procedures and often when a dentist is not available. However, an important provider, healthcare provider in dentistry is excluded from this proposal, and those are dental hygienists, who are the dental team members most responsible for providing essential preventive services as well as periodontal therapy services to the public. The Center of Medicaid and Medicare Services in 2013, 416 data, is that 36% of children in this state received a preventive dental service that year. Now you can see the numbers are quite low, we really do need dental hygienists to be more involved wherever we can place them. To Mr. Schoenbaum's point about employment settings and numbers of providers available, there is no shortage of dental hygienists in traditional places, I might add. However, there are many places where dental hygienists could serve and are needed. As you know, rural areas and remote areas where access is not as easy. In 2001, this legislature addressed the need for more hygienists in health professional shortage areas by creating a new model of dental hygiene, allowing them to practice without the dentist on site through a collaborative agreement with the dentist and specifying certain practice settings, such as Head Start programs, community clinics, tribal clinics, and so on. And the list is long, so I won't go into it. I'd like to say that in 2011, the Minnesota Department of Health put out a report on collaborative practice hygienists, where only 2% of those hygienists were in rural areas and about 17% in micropolitan areas. It's difficult to assess how many collaborative hygienists we have right now, but we do need to encourage them to work more remotely, which they can do. An example of this need comes from the Northern Dental Access Center in Bemidji, which employs one collaborative practice dental hygienist and finds it increasingly difficult to have her out of the building providing services, and are looking forward to hiring their second collaborative practice dental hygienist, who will become eligible soon. And this is a common refrain. Currently, dental hygienists are considered a primary care provider by the National Health Service Corps and are eligible for their loan repayment program. This is a national program with the promise that they work at an approved high-need underserved area. And I think Minnesota needs to follow this lead. In addition, dental hygienists also incur significant debt, maybe not that of a physician or maybe even a nurse practitioner, but to attain a bachelor degree in dental hygiene is anywhere from $27,000 to $75,000, depending on the institution. And this is really is comparable to the average student debt identified by the Minnesota Department of Health for public health nurses, allied health faculty, dental therapists, and mental health professionals, which is between $34,000 and $69,000, so about in the same ballpark range. So given those facts, I encourage you to think about adding that oral health provider that's left out of the dental team. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, members? Okay, thank you so much for being here. Next we have Sue Abderholden. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. In the 2013 legislature directed MNSCU to develop a comprehensive plan to increase the number of people working at all levels of our mental health system and to ensure appropriate coursework and training and to create a more culturally diverse workforce. The reason for the legislation was that 9 out of our 11 regions of the state are designated as mental health workforce shortage areas. And it's not just psychiatrists, it's all mental health professionals. We have counties in our state that do not have licensed clinical social workers or psychologists or nurse practitioners who specialize in mental health. And there are shortages of marriage and family therapists and professional clinical counselors. You should have received this really, truly wonderful report. I know you get a lot of reports on your desk, but I would actually urge you to read this one. It was actually developed, again, by MNSCU. It was based on hearings that were held around the state, surveys for people to provide input, and a summit that was attended by over 150 people. There are many, many good recommendations in here on how to address those three issues. One of the key recommendations is to expand the loan forgiveness program to mental health professionals in rural areas and for mental health professionals from diverse cultural and ethnic backgrounds. So the report actually talks about both, but the report, of course, just came out. House File 211 is really a great way to begin to address the shortages in the mental health field in the rural areas of our state. One thing I want to point out is that even if you expand funding for our mental health system and our mental health services, which of course I hope you do, we may not be able to meet those needs if we do not have mental health providers and mental health professionals to hire. And right now, as you heard from Shauna, we, you know, actually our providers have trouble finding people who can work in this field. So in order to expand our mental health services across the state, we need more mental health professionals. So I urge support of this bill. It will help us expand treatment and services to both children and adults with mental illnesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Any questions from members? Okay, thank you so much for being here. We have Kathleen Picard next. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Picard. I'm a licensed physical therapist, and I'm the legislative chair for the State Association. I want to thank you for this opportunity to ask for inclusion of physical therapists in this bill. While this loan forgiveness program is designed to fill the gap in health and health care disparities, in underserved areas and populations, it doesn't offer any rehab component or health promotion component. Physical therapists can offer that rehab component, and we work in health promotion. The physical therapists of today are educated at a doctoral level in a primary care model for individuals across the lifespan, birth to death, and that includes health promotion. As essential members of the healthcare team, we play an important role in the management of a lot of chronic diseases that are not usually thought about in the context of physical therapy, such as diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and even mental illness. The connection is movement, which is a fundamental building block for activity and exercise, without which we can't have a healthy population. And physical therapists work in that realm to improve the overall health of the population and to reduce the cost of health care. That's the triple aim that was referred to previously by Steve Gottwald. Healthcare reform requires us to build a system that brings the patient to the right provider at the right place at the right time. So we believe that removing the barriers to physical therapy and allowing patients to have access to our services can contribute to those reform goals in a significant way. The data shows that there is actually a growing demand for physical therapy and that there is a greater gap in workforce for physical therapy than the other primary care providers that were listed under the National Health Service Corps. That includes physicians. Our national association, APTA, predicts that by the year 2020, nationwide there will be a $40,000 person shortage of physical therapists in the nation. Our debt is significant. When students graduate with a doctoral degree, their typical debt is $120,000. And you couple that with their average starting salary at $60,000 to $65,000, that's a big hole to dig out of. My last comments ask you to think about this program in a very different way. Out-of-the-box thinking that was talked about earlier. We believe that including physical therapy in this loan forgiveness program can help fill the workforce gap in primary care. A significant portion of what comes through the primary care door are conditions that are classified as musculoskeletal conditions. Things like foot pain, headaches, shoulder pain, back pain, the kinds of things that you would go to a physical therapist for because that is what we're trained to manage. So we feel that we can work side by side with physicians to help fill that workforce shortage. Data actually shows, for example, under low back pain, claims data shows that the sooner a person gets to the physical therapist, and if they start with physical therapy first, rather than entering the healthcare system through physicians and other primary care providers, the total cost of the episode of care, not just the cost of therapy, but the total cost of that episode of care is significantly less with a much better outcome. Citizens of Minnesota have had the right to access physical therapy services without referral since 1980, and each year more and more people do. We believe that PTs can help unload the primary care physician in these underserved areas and allow the physicians then to focus on the medical conditions of complexity to which they are trained. Physical therapists stand ready to serve in rural areas as well as other underserved areas in the state and help us do that by including physical therapy in this legislation. If you're interested in that, the citation for the definition of a physical therapist is 148.65 subdivision 2. Thank you, and I'll remain for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Picard. Any questions, members, at this time? Okay, thank you so much for being here. And members, we do have one more testifier who did sign up in advance. She just was not put on the agenda, but Melissa Haley. If you could just come forward and introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Melissa Haley. I am here representing the Autism Treatment Association of Minnesota. It's a group of 10 autism service providers who primarily work in the area of ABA therapy, applied behavioral analysis therapy. I know some of you are familiar with that, so I won't spend nodding your heads. I will not spend a lot of time. It's early intervention therapy that's proven. It's kind of the gold standard, at least for a high percentage of children with autism. Our providers represent about 500 children, predominantly in the metro area. Children outstate Minnesota and rural areas are not able to get this therapy on any kind of a reliable basis. They may be able to do a little telemedicine here or there, but they're not able to access the intensive therapy that's necessary to give them a chance of recovery. And so what we're asking for is for inclusion of BCBAs into this bill. That's the board certified behavior analysts. Those are the kind of mid-level practitioners who do the bulk of this therapy. The therapists are supervised, generally speaking, by a mental health professional, so we're also very supportive that that's included in the bill, and we thank Representative Keel for that, and are very supportive of this bill otherwise. But we would ask that you consider including the BCBAs in this as this goes forward, and so that all children in the state have true access to this medically necessary and proven therapy. I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for being here. Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so the other people that have come up to say they should be included, I understood a little more about what they do and what their professions are, but this one I'm less familiar with. So could you just give us a little basic information about the loans or what the training is, how much debt a person accumulates, what the beginning salary is? I mean, those are the kinds of issues that we're thinking about when we think about loan forgiveness and, you know, whether it's an effective tool to encourage people to serve in these places.
Ms. Haley, there is one facility of higher education, St. Cloud State, that has a program for BCBAs right now. Other people would do an online program. And Minnesota is losing BCBAs to Wisconsin or other states currently. We probably have maybe about 150 in the state right now. I can't speak to the amount of what it costs to get the degree. I can get that information and provide it to you. I can tell you that our providers across the board are having staffing shortages, getting and retaining staff, very high turnover. All of them are struggling to be sustainable so that the current kids who are receiving this therapy can continue to receive the therapy. And the reason they're losing staff is they're unable to pay them a high enough wage to pay back their loans and everything else that they need to do.
Thank you, Ms. Haley. Any other questions, members? Okay, thank you so much for being here. Members, any further discussion to the bill or questions for the author? Okay, Representative Keel, any closing comments?
Yes, members, I'm Madam Chair and members, I really appreciate you hearing this bill. And as we've discussed early on, that this is just one of the tools that we need to use in order to provide health care for Minnesotans. And some of our representatives pointed out, especially Representative Moran and Representative Huntley, that Representative Loeffler, that we need to make sure that we are adequately providing the availability for all citizens that they can access that health. I would appreciate the comment this guy over here.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Must be the end of the day. To talk about transportation and how important that is and how we need to look at how far and how well people can get or cannot get to the site that they need to in order to even reach doctors, nurses, dentists, mental health providers. So, and I have to share one just tiny little thing. I think she left, but Ms. Reitmeier, Shauna Reitmeier, she's from my hometown, and this is how small things are. She grew up across the section. I can see her father's house from my kitchen window, and she was my babysitter for my three older children. And it was really nice to see her. She left home, worked in Michigan for a while, was in Washington, D.C., and chose to come back home, and has done an excellent job at moving back to the Crookston area. So it does happen. So anyway, but I would thank you very much for this time.
Thank you so much, Representative Keel. Members, with that, I will renew my motion that Representative Keel's bill, House File 211, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Keel and testifiers, for being here. And members, with that, just a reminder that our next meeting is tomorrow, same place, same time, and it is EMS Day. So with that, we are adjourned.